Someone said, when the leaves fall, you know it's autumn, and descend into a dark blue place. To get here, you must experience where the loom is in motion, but a pattern hasn't yet formed. When the leaves fall, you know it's autumn. When the leaves fall, you know it's autumn, and descend into a dark blue place. To get here, you must experience where the loom is in motion, but a pattern hasn't yet formed. We can rest in being here just as here is, just as we are. Rest from the effort of trying to see, trying to see the patterns. We can enjoy being humans together right here and now. in that dark blue place, descending into a dark blue place can feel a little bit like being in the depths of a stream. And someone brought in another image. It says, the falling flowers consciously go along with the stream. The stream has no sense of carrying the fallen flowers. In my meditation, I can feel myself as both. I can notice the falling flowers going along with the stream. This and this and this. And I can also feel that stream that has no sense of carrying any fallen flowers.
Begin walking meditation. Return to your seats. We'll now have a Dharma talk from Roshi Sarabender.
Good evening. The sun dipped down behind the mountain at about 4 o'clock this afternoon. It really feels like evening now for sure, the evening of a beautiful day. And I'm going to start off with a different quote from the ones that I invited you to sit with. But it's connected. And and it was these are actually the things I've been quoting came from the comments following case 88 in the Book of Serenity, which is one we've been messing with in the Khan group about no seeing in the Sarangama. So I should just bring the Khan in a little bit, which says, when I don't see, why don't I see the place of my not seeing? If I see the not seeing, then naturally, that's not an image that's going unseen. If I don't see the realm of my not seeing, then this isn't a something. How can it not be you? So I'm still really very much hanging out in the territory of the relationship that this Khan brings up, and not only our relationship to our own seeing or not seeing, but in a time when we're so keenly aware, painfully aware, of not seeing how others are seeing. What I'm noticing is that there's a gate there, that there's something really beautiful about how we're noticing what we don't see. And we can fall into a, there's something wrong with this, that I can't see it, that they can't see what I see, and I can't see what they see or are not seeing. But there's also something really beautiful about that, about realizing that in a flash, the radiance of each being is present. And in a flash, I don't understand. And what about that? So there's that feeling of danger and opportunity, you know, of the 8,000 foot cliff that is magnificent and awe-inspiring, awful in some way. So suddenly during walking meditation, I had a memory that I had not planned to bring in. I have another story to bring in, but this memory applies, I think. It was from when we were, it was the night before we moved my mother out of her house and into assisted living. And family members were there, and we had dinner, and my mother's dementia was such that she didn't really know what was happening. And there wasn't really a way to do anything about that. But we wanted to all be there with her for this last evening. And someone knocked on the door just as we were sitting down to dinner. And she was a woman, Joan was her name, who was a member of mom and dad's church. And she had also worked for mom at various times, cleaning and cooking and doing things like that. And I think she was a member of the Church Women United group that mom was part of. And I was aware that Joan had been a kind of mixture for mom, because she was very generous and dear, and she also sort of took mom's time and attention at times when that was hard for mom to share. And Joan didn't always get that. And so she'd been a sort of mixture of a blessing and a problem in mom's life. And there she was at the door, and she said, "Oh, I brought some food." And I, being aware of all of that and that this was just family, said, "Oh, it's so kind of you to bring that. And I'm sorry, I can't invite you in because we're just sitting down to this, you know, family dinner on the last night my mom's here." Fortunately, my sister-in-law heard that Joan was at the door and just came to the door and said, "Joan, come on in," and just set another place. And she was part of the evening. And it was a little awkward. And man, it was so much better for us to have that dinner and have it be a little awkward than for me to have sent her away. And so the way that connects to this, when I don't see my not seeing, was it somehow my trying to see the situation and figure it out and respond, you know, according to what seemed right, completely got in the way of just inviting Joan in to join the dinner. That it was in the way of my just responding humanly to a human situation. So I'll just sort of put that aside. But it connects. It also connects to an I Ching reading that the steering committee had a little retreat yesterday. And so that we could just kind of absorb what had come from the All Sangha gathering and see how we could, what it felt like to be a team and to be ready to move forward and support the Sangha in holding this field of awakening in the enterprise of our awakening together. And we did an I Ching reading as part of the morning. And I want to read you. So we asked the ancestors for insights about this. And we got the hexagram that's called Dwelling People. And it's about the hearth fire and the ancestral altar. People who live and work together, supportive friends, an intimate group, home, household, clan, blood relations, nourish, sustain, a spiritual way or school of thought. The old character shows a pig inside a roof or house, sign of riches and plenty, and a person kneeling in prayer or submission. It means, in another section, the text says, it means our own, our ancestors, our altar. The royal house and a school of thought or way that provides a spiritual dwelling for its followers. All things inside or way. W-E-I, protection. Being among one's own people, concord and safety. And it says more, but it's the response says, this is a time of living, working, and sharing with others. Care for your relationships with the people who share your space and your activities. And so that was pretty much right to the point, wasn't it? And the thing that the way that connected for me so deeply with this koan was that there's something important about taking the invitation that I read into the meditation to let ourselves this autumn, as the leaves have fallen, to let ourselves descend into a place where we can experience where the loom is in motion, but a pattern hasn't yet formed. Something so important about not having to have a position about seeing or not seeing. Because actually, of course, you can't see not seeing because it isn't something. So that's the first thing that kind of gets there. And when we think we're seeing, somebody else is not seeing. That's pretty tricky because we're likely to be seeing, we're likely to have formed the opinion that they are not seeing what we see. In other words, that what we see is right and somehow they're off track. Whereas in fact, if we can have this awareness that the loom of a loom in motion, but a pattern not yet formed, there's something so real about that. It feels to me as if it allows presence with each other while acknowledging that, as another part of the koan suggests, you can't accompany somebody in a way. You cannot accompany somebody seeing, because you can't see it. So at the same time, then the gate is the presence of that person, of that being, an eternal radiance and an 8,000 foot cliff. And it feels sometimes as if everything depends on that grace, that always the presence of the other being is there in its radiance. And when I can recognize the large belonging being held together by the vastness as it is right here in your room, the vastness of your floor and ceiling and all of the little things inside. Then a great deal is possible. And so that the other connection that we've been playing with is with Yunmen's, the koan where Yunmen says, each of us has their own light. Yeah. If you go looking for it, you can't see it. It's dark. What is your light? So I'm not wanting to like make an equation out of this, like my not seeing is my light. But there's a way in which I can feel the vibrancy, I can feel the aliveness that is present when there is no one to see and nothing needing to be identified. And I think the more I learn to trust that vitality is the vitality of this, is the vitality of us, the vitality of being here miraculously. The less likely I am to go to the door and say, oh, thank you, I'm so sorry, I can't invite you in. So the beauty and the opportunity in not being able to see my not seeing or your not seeing is what's most present for me tonight. So I think I'd like to turn to this. The story I would want to bring in. And connect it a little bit to Rilke's, that thing that Rilke said about living the questions, about allowing the sort of deeply curious nature of how we see each other and can't see each other, how even after being married for many years, you look at the person you're living with and realizing you don't begin to know them. and living the questions. How do we, what is the, what's the texture of the way that we experience each other in the deep unknowing of this time? How that liberates our curiosity in a way. So that the story is the story of the Minotaur, and the reason I've gotten so curious about it is because of this poem I came across, which I'll read to you. So I have brought it in before, so some of you will remember something of it. It's by Franz Wright, called Depiction of Childhood, after Picasso. And the Picasso picture, I can't remember if we put it up before, I think somebody did briefly, but let me see if I can screen share it. Do I have the ability to screen share? Thank you. Here we go. The poem's on there, but hopefully you'll be able to see the image as well. If I can make it, can I make it move? Why can't I make it move? No. There we go. Okay. You can kind of see, it's a little bit hard to see that image, but you see the little girl, and then there are various, you know, creatures and beings, but there's the Minotaur reaching. Okay, so that was the Picasso picture. And I'll just leave the poem up for a minute. No, I don't think so, because we can't, it messes with how we can see each other. Are you okay if I don't? I'll just say it. We can, if, you can ask for it later if you want it brought up again. So the poem says, it is the little girl guiding the Minotaur with her free hand. That devourer and all the terror he's accustomed to effortlessly emanating, his ability to paralyze merely by becoming present, entranced somehow and transformed into a bewildered and who knows, grateful gentleness. And with the other hand, lifting her lamp. So I'll read the whole poem again. It is the little girl guiding the Minotaur with her free hand. That devourer and all the terror he's accustomed to effortlessly emanating, his ability to paralyze merely by becoming present, entranced somehow and transformed into a bewildered and who knows, grateful gentleness. And with the other hand, lifting her lamp. So a little bit of background about the Minotaur. Some of you undoubtedly know more than I do, but I'll tell you what caught me this time. So often depicted with head and tail of a bull and the body of a man, imprisoned at the center of a labyrinth. So the story is that Minos, Poseidon sent him a bull to sacrifice, a special, beautiful white bull. And it was so gorgeous, Minos or Aegeus, I think that's the same person, cheated and kept it. And he was found out. He tried sacrificing something else, and that did not fool Poseidon, who punished him by making his wife fall in love with the bull and find a way to mate with the bull. And so this Minotaur, who was born of that union, had no natural sense of nourishment, didn't know what he could eat. So he ate humans. And so in order to prevent, to avert plague, part of the punishment was that if the, you know, Minotaur didn't get fed, there would be plague. Minos required 7 boys and 7 girls every 7 years or every year to be brought into the labyrinth that was built to keep the Minotaur and be eaten. So along came Theseus, who volunteered to kill the Minotaur. But meanwhile, Ariadne, who was Minos's daughter, fell in love with Theseus and didn't want him to go in and get murdered or eaten. And so probably the main story has her giving him a ball of thread so that he could find his way back out, and helped him, went with him. And afterwards, when they were safely out, Ariadne went with Theseus, who abandoned her on an island, and then didn't follow Minos or Aegeus's instructions to raise a white flag, meaning that they had survived. And so instead, Aegeus decided they hadn't survived and threw himself off a cliff. However, this was the Athenian view of the story. And apparently the Etruscans had a different version. And so I don't, and then the Cretans also had their story. And theirs had to do with the sun. They had depicted the sun as a bull, so that the mating of human and bull was a sacred union. But in any case, the Minotaur came to represent sort of brute violence. But apparently, some of the Italian writers and later Picasso were very much aware of how tormented the Minotaur was, what torture really was inflicted on the Minotaur. And the author Borges also wrote a kind of horror story, but which ended like this, with Theseus saying to Ariadne, "Would you believe it, Ariadne? The Minotaur scarcely defended himself." So let me read the poem again. It is the little girl guiding the Minotaur with her free hand. That devourer and all the terror he's accustomed to effortlessly emanating, his ability to paralyze merely by becoming present. entranced somehow, and transformed into a bewildered and, who knows, grateful gentleness. And with the other hand, lifting her lamp. I don't know the actual date of that, of Picasso painting that, but the style of it is, it sort of makes me wonder if it wasn't, you know, in the same general period in which he painted his Guernica, you know, a time of terrible war and horrors inflicted by people on each other. So to me, there's a connection with that. To get here, you must experience where the loom is in motion, but a pattern hasn't yet formed. And something about then the way that this time, which allows us to, you know, feel the wall in the dark, to bless this poverty of darkness, of not being able to make a light. And the way in which then everything is lit in some way. So I think I'll stop there and see what's coming up for you.